This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. I'm with Mr. Robert Rennebaum in his office at the University of Wisconsin Foundation Center, and it's February 7th, 1990. Today we're going to talk about his involvement with the University of Wisconsin Foundation. Discuss first, before we get involved with you personally, discuss when and how the University of Wisconsin Foundation was started.
The foundation was organized in 1945 by a group of alumni and friends who, most of whom had been instrumental in founding the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation in, I believe that was 1928. But some of the key people in the founding of the University of Wisconsin Foundation were of the group that founded WARF, and they, of course, founded the foundation for an entirely separate purpose, although the end product was the same of supporting the university. Our role was to support it through gifts and grants, whereas WARF was primarily involved in patenting and also doing an excellent job of investing the patent proceeds.
Now, when before the University of Wisconsin Foundation was founded, who handled the gifts and the grants?
All the gifts went directly to the Board of Regents, and there was no organized fundraising at all other than possibly the Memorial Union when the campaign for the Union took place after World War I. That was supposedly the only organized fundraising effort that had taken place with the university. It had received a large number of gifts just by the nature of being there and people knowing that you give to a university, but there was no effort to get people giving on an annual basis or to organize deferred giving wills and the like.
So if somebody wanted to give $100,000 for a professorship or whatever, let's say, they would simply call the Board of Regents office, or they would be referred to the Board of Regents office, and would a regent then handle?
No, I think it would more than likely have been a contact with the president of the university on a large gift or a dean, much as happens today, but there was no organized follow-up or no way to develop a list of prospects for gifts of this type, which is what we are doing today, of course.
Now, when was this started?
1945, March 5th, I believe it was, March 20th, 1945.
In terms of other universities, let's just say Big Ten universities, Michigan, for example, Illinois, Minnesota, did they have anything like the equivalent to the foundation?
No, they were all starting at that time with the post-war. Actually, it was the excess profits tax that encouraged the foundation to begin operations, in that at the end of World War II, business and industry were making some pretty good profits on war production, and there was some excess taxes placed on those profits, and it was thought that it was better to give the money away than to be taxed by the government. So it was deductible back then, and that encouraged the group to found the University of Wisconsin Foundation. And actually, most of the Big Ten schools were just getting into the process themselves. So the first foundation was formed before the turn of the century back at the University of Kansas. It wasn't called a foundation, it was called the Kansas University Endowment Association. But it was founded because in the state of Kansas, you could not give money to the university. You had to give it to the state, and the state could determine that the money might be better used for the prisons or the highways or whatever. And the only way that citizens and alumni of the University of Kansas could make a gift would be to form this endowment association as a private agency that would accept gifts. And so they're the granddaddy of them all. But most Big Ten and major private or major public universities got into the business at the closing of World War II. Now, the private schools, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, they've been doing it forever and ever. So we were just following their lead, but for all practical purposes, a post-war product.
This is a two-part question. Was there any one university or college that the university particularly modeled the foundation after? And was the foundation in its founding unique in any way as opposed to the other schools?
No, I don't believe there was. It was just kind of a general trend as we see today, different events take place and then they quickly spread across the country. I think it was part of a trend. I'm not aware of any school that we were patterned after in starting the foundation.
You said that some of the WARF members were involved also with mm-hmm. starting the foundation. Were there any particular shakers and movers who got it going?
Well, two names that come to the forefront are George I. Haight and Howard I. Potter, both of Chicago. Haight was a lawyer and Potter was an insurance executive. Particularly Haight. Haight is really considered the father of both organizations because he was the first chairman of WARF and he was also the first chairman of the foundation. Mr. Potter was the first president of the foundation. And they were instrumental in guiding both organizations in their early days.
Now, George Haight, of course, Haight is a name that anyone associated with UW history recognizes as mm-hmm. one of the true leading, I guess you almost call him shadow figure, because he does a lot of behind-the-scenes work.
Right.
I don't mean that
uh-huh.
in a negative sense at all. Did you know Mr. Haight, and was there any, why did he get himself involved in WARF, and was there any particular reason?
Well, Haight was born out at Cambridge, Wisconsin, on a farm, and as was so typical of the times, he came to the university and worked his way through school and got himself a law degree and was intensely loyal to the university thereafter. He was a great success in the legal business in Chicago, and he just never forgot his roots. We have that happening often today, but it was quite prevalent in those days for a youngster to come in with no money and get an education and then end up very successful to remember the university for what it did for him or her.
Now, when the foundation did start, where was it located?
The first foundation offices were in was formerly the First Wisconsin National Bank building on Park and University Avenue. We had a very small office. I came to work with the foundation in 1955. At that time, it was 10 years old. And when I walked in the door, there was a man, Basil Peterson, who was called an administrative secretary, and a young woman secretary, and two small rooms. And I moved into that room with Mr. Peterson, and there were three of us for perhaps the next 2 years. We started to expand, and there wasn't room for us in the bank building, so we moved into an old rooming house on Sterling Court, which was subsequently demolished to make way for the LV Mart Center. So our office at the time was just about exactly in the middle of the LV Mart Center.
During this first 10 years of the foundation, before your arrival,
mm-hmm.
What was accomplished by the foundation? Were there any noteworthy accomplishments in that time?
Yes, of course, we must remember that people were not used to giving to a public university, so the dollar success was not as great as I'm sure everybody had hoped for. When the foundation was organized, its first goal was a Actually, one of the reasons for organizing also, besides what we've talked about already, was that the centennial of the university was coming up in 1948. And so the foundation, in cooperation with the university, established a goal of $5 million to be presented to the university in 1948-49 as a centennial gift from alumni and friends. And being organized in 1945, they gave them 3 years to raise $5 million. They didn't reach their goal, but we, of course, eventually did. I think the goal was not reached really until about 1955. The goal was split into a major project, which was the Wisconsin Center. That was $2.5 million, and the rest of the $5 million, an equal amount of $2.5 million, would be raised for professorships, scholarships, fellowships, and other special purposes that would not normally expect help from the state. So while the initial goal was not reached in the time frame that they had established for themselves, it was reached, and in 1958 we dedicated the Wisconsin Center as visible evidence of reaching this goal. In the meantime, quite a number of scholarships had been given, and the foundation had established a professorship in the history department. The Frederick Jackson Turner Chair in American History, which was used at the time to keep Professor Merle Curdy on the campus. And as you know, Merle Curdy came to be one of Wisconsin's most distinguished historians of all times. So while the beginning was somewhat modest, I think it was $12,000 a year for the scholarship or for the professorship, it did establish a trend that has been carried on since then of acquiring funds for special professorships, which has enabled the university to keep key people on the staff.
So Curdy was the first.
Curdy was the first.
I think an appropriate number one, for sure. On that, a question on that professorship, and then I want to go back to the first 10 years for just one moment. Was that professorship established because Curdy was being courted by other schools, or was this a preventative measure?
I think it. I don't know the details, but it's just been said generally it helped save Curdy for the University of Wisconsin. So I can only assume that that he was being sought after by other schools. It was named in honor of Frederick Jackson Turner, who was also one of Wisconsin's early and very distinguished historians, who was taken away by the University of California at Berkeley. So there might have been some reason for naming it after after Turner and giving it to Curdy.
A little irony in there. That's nice. Now, we're back to the first 10 years, and your little cubby hole's up in the bank building on University and Park. You had mentioned Peterson and that other woman who was secretary there.
Yes.
Were there any other employees? Was there a director or anything like that in those first
10 years? No, that was the complete staff, and I was hired as the executive director, and came in 1955, and that made three of us, and eventually there was four when we hired another secretary, and gradually we started filling in with other individuals until today we're over 60, I believe it's 65 members of the staff.
How did your hiring come about?
I had heard that the foundation was interested in a person to offer some leadership in a way at the time that involved sales experience, and I was sales manager for a major dairy equipment firm in Chicago, dairy and ice cream equipment, and of course part of my territory was Madison. As a matter of fact, I worked out of Chicago but lived in Madison and didn't want to leave Madison. I had reached the point where I had to either move into Chicago or start losing ground in the corporate world. And I had heard of the foundation's opening. So I interviewed with the executive committee of the foundation in Milwaukee in, I believe it was March or April or possibly May of 1955. And Mr. Irwin Meyer, the publisher of the Milwaukee Journal, and Howard Potter, I mentioned him as original, and Gordon Fox, who subsequently established a professorship here, and Joseph Cutler. I probably could remember the rest of them, but at least they were the principal people. And at the time, there was no school that you could go to learn fundraising. It was the other universities were picking primarily people with sales background or journalistic background or banking background to head up their fundraising program. And I'd had 7 years of sales and sales management, handling salesmen under me, so they must have felt I was qualified to do it and had a good Wisconsin background, having gone to school here and played football and so forth. And a name that was recognized in the state at the time. So that's how I came to be the executive director.
Now, you said there was an executive committee that interviewed mm-hmm. you. Tell me a little bit about the executive. Were they appointed when the foundation was founded in 1945?
The executive committee is a branch of the board of directors. At the time, we had a board of directors, I believe it was 25 members. And that's a bit unwieldy to get 25 people from all over the country. So there was an executive committee of, I forget at the time, there was 12, I believe. Now it's up to 16. And the executive committee functions between meetings of the board of directors. So they were all members of the board, but they were selected because they were, for the most part, Milwaukee, Chicago, and southern Wisconsin, which enabled them to get together quite often as was necessary to run the or to set the policy for the foundation.
This leads to an interesting area for me, and that's the interfacing between the foundation and the university itself. You talked about the fundraising for the centennial, mm-hmm. which I understand. Is this committee, is this board of directors, how are they connected? How are you connected with the university directly? How autonomous are you? Maybe that's another way of putting it.
Well, we are an autonomous organization, and we have to be for our tax-exempt status and for various reasons that some legal and some just traditional, I guess. We've always been separate, but we're separate to the extent that the foundation and its volunteer leadership and staff, with the help of the university, does the fundraising. We're sort of the mechanics that carry out the fundraising program. We don't attempt to set university policy or establish university priorities for what the money should be for. We look to the university, again, we, the foundation, a separate organization, looks to the university for its priorities, and when they tell us we need a new building, we need more scholarships, we need more fellowships, whatever it is, we in turn will go about the task of trying to find the necessary money to fund those priorities. Now, through the years, I would say 99 and 44, 100% of what the university wanted were approved by the foundation's board and established as targets for us. But there have been occasionally projects that we thought might better be the duty of the state to support, or that possibly another governmental source or group might support it rather than having a fundraising campaign for the project. And we've suggested to the university that they perhaps follow that other course and not try to raise it from money, because we've always told our potential donors that we're in the business of getting money to support projects at the university which would not normally be supported by tax dollars, but yet which are essential to a great university. And I'm speaking primarily of public type buildings like the Wisconsin Center, the LVM Art Center, the Alumni House, the Carolyn Tower, and before our time, the Memorial Union, although we have raised substantial amounts for additions and refurbishing of the Union. But into that class would be the special professorships and chairs and scholarships. Now, subsequent to our founding, scholarships did become an important item for the state, loans by the federal government. And when we were founded, they didn't have those programs, so it was much more urgent that we get out and get money for scholarships and student aid to help youngsters get an education.
Also, scholarship programs, there weren't that many of them.
No,
at the time.
No.
After World War II, a different type of clientele entered the university.
Yeah. Of course, after World War II, the bulk of the students were veterans who came on a GI Bill, so you really didn't need scholarships for them, but nonetheless, there were a lot of people who hadn't gone into service, younger students who often needed help, so there was need all the time, but the bulk of the big swell of people after World War II did not need scholarships because of the GI Bill.
When you started as president of the University of Wisconsin Foundation, you said that somebody from the university would let the foundation know.
Mm-hmm.
Was there like a contact person, or would President Fred come to you personally, or how did that operate?
That has always been my duty while I was executive director and subsequently president. Incidentally, I had the title of executive director for 25 years, and in 1983, the title was changed to president, and there really wasn't a change in duties, but it was just a restructuring, and the foundation chief operating officer became the president, and the head layperson became the chairman of the foundation. So that change took place in 1983. Now, going back to the priority business, it's always been my responsibility, and it's now Sandy Wilcox's responsibility since he succeeded me, to be the chief liaison with the university's top administrator, which in the early days was the president, E.B. Fred, and then Conrad Elvium, and then Fred Harrington. And then, of course, merger took place. At the time, John Weaver came to be president, and Weaver became president of the system, and Edwin Young was chancellor of the Madison campus during most of that period. And the relationship between the foundation and the university was through the chancellor from that point on, because the president of the system had responsibility for all of the campuses. And while we work with the president and still function as the system's foundation when they need a foundation, we are primarily associated with Madison.
Let's stick to the pre-merger as a way of kind of dividing the two things here, and talk about the three presidents you mentioned just a moment ago, E.B. Fred, Conrad Elvium, and Fred Harvey Harrington.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me what agenda each of these, did the agenda differ significantly between these three men as to what, how they used or what they expected or wanted from the foundation?
Yes. Of course, the foundation started during the tenure of E.B. Fred, and the goals were relatively modest, and it was more an educational process trying to get people acquainted with the fact that a public university did need private contributions. So it was there was a good deal of educating at the time, and E.B. Fred was very good at helping to condition people to give. He was a wonderful salesman, if I could use that expression. But the goals were not overly ambitious. I think they were realistic. So he naturally, beyond the goal of the Wisconsin Center and the total $5 million goal, I'm not aware of any specific requests he had. When Elvin became president, he did so right after we had dedicated the Wisconsin Center, and we were starting to move in a pretty good direction, so he solicited the faculty to find out what they wanted next in the way of a major project through fundraising, and came up with the idea of an art center. That was by far the leading priority of the faculty. So we started the campaign for the LVM Art Center. It wasn't the LVM Art Center, it was just the Art Center. And while Conrad LVM was president, he worked very hard on the campaign. In fact, he was working very hard on being president of the university, and it was just too much for him, and he died in his office in Bascom Hall. So shortly thereafter, even though he was a scientist, the foundation and the university agreed that the Art Center should be named in his honor. He was a strong patron of the arts as a scientist. He collected paintings on his trips abroad and the like. He loved artwork. So it was very logical that we named the Art Center after him, and that was early in the campaign, so the people who donated to the Art Center knew they were honoring this great man when they gave to it. Following his death, Fred Harrington became the president of the university, and we, of course, dedicated the Art Center, and by that time we were really on a roll and starting to get some pretty good-sized gifts in the foundation. Fred Harrington was very aggressive as the president of the university. He presided over its very rapid growth and the establishment of campuses at Kenosha, the Parkside campus there, and the Green Bay campus, and the expansion of the Milwaukee campus. So he had many needs, including those three outlying campuses, and was much more aggressive in seeking private funds, having us seek private funds and urging us to do so, than either E.B. Fred or Conrad Elvin were.
What were his projects, his pet projects?
Well, I don't think we had any building projects at the time, but there was a strong effort to get more money for professorships and special institutes and centers, programs that would attract and keep high quality scholars here. We also had projects in both Green Bay and Parkside to help get those campuses established and get the tradition of private giving going at those campuses. At Milwaukee, we undertook a campaign to build a student union. The first student union was built as a result of the campaign conducted by the foundation.
So UWM started sharing in the money at this point.
Right, but we were always careful not to intermingle the money. If somebody gave us money who was a graduate of Madison, we knew they did not want the money to go to Parkside or Green Bay or Milwaukee. So we kept that money very much segregated. And by the same token, when somebody gave us money for UWM or UW-Parkside, we made sure that every dime went to that purpose.
Was it Harrington's initiative that got the foundation to give money to those things, or was that a natural
evolution? At that time, we were still the University of Wisconsin, and that meant the four campuses I mentioned plus University Extension, and it was not until we had merger with the state college system or state university system that we brought in. By that merger, we brought in nine more foundations into the system. It wasn't until then that it became pretty much a divided program, so that each campus was responsible for its own fundraising. We continued to assist Parkside and Milwaukee and Green Bay even after merger, but eventually Milwaukee organized its own foundation, as did Parkside, but we still continue to function for Green Bay even today. We're still the foundation. They have people on the scene up there who, a vice chancellor and a staff who do the actual fundraising along with volunteers, but we advise them and we invest their money for them and handle certain functions. As a matter of fact, we've done that for all of the, not all of them, but we've been available to all of the foundations in the system. Because of our size and our experience, we're perhaps in better shape to handle life income funds or a pooled life income fund than the individual campuses are. So some of the campuses have accepted our invitation to use us for complicated or major gifts or investment programs that they would find more difficult to do themselves.
Now, I know in talking with the people from Wharf and reading about that there was quite a to-do about hard science versus humanities, mm-hmm. money for research in those areas. Was that ever an issue with the foundation?
Well, of course, the hard sciences had been so well supported by Wharf that most of the priorities we received from the university were for the social sciences and the humanities, and that is, we collect an awful lot of money for computer sciences and various other hard sciences today, but the program at Wharf has been so successful that it kind of takes the urgency out of trying to raise money for the for biotechnology, for example. But surely if there's someone inclined to give money for that, we do encourage it and accept it and supplement actually what Wharf is doing. But they have continued to do such a wonderful job that we have, for the most part, concentrated in the social sciences and the humanities for our extra efforts.
Now, E.B. Fred once said that what all a social scientist needs for research is a desk to put his feet on. going back to the three presidents we've been discussing thus far, did either of them turn to you? You said you did basically humanities-oriented stuff. Did Fred or Elvium turn to you particularly for these, since Wharf wasn't really giving at that point?
Well, I think a case in point would be the Elvium Art Center, which which was a high priority of Conrad Elvium, who at the time was one of our most distinguished heart scientists, a great biochemist. But his view of the overall university was that, I think his view was that there was not an emergency in the heart sciences. They were getting support from the federal government and particularly from Wharf, and that we needed a beautiful art museum to handle our collection and to encourage more gifts of art as part of our overall learning process, our cultural program at the university. So I think that was a pretty good example of a hard scientist pushing hard for a cultural project.
So it would be more likely that he would go to the foundation for the cultural enrichment aspect of the university as opposed to Wharf?
Right. And then when Harrington became president, being a historian and sometimes being on the short end of the stick when it came to gifts like Wharf was able to transfer to the university, he strongly encouraged programs in the social sciences.
Now you said that, let's get to the professorships for a moment. Were the professorships mainly in the humanities or were they just sort of scattered all about?
They were mainly in the humanities. I should qualify that. I think we had two in history and one in political science among our early professorships. We really didn't get going on professorships until the campaign Forward with Wisconsin took place in the late 70s and early 80s. And that's when, at the urging of Edwin Young, the chancellor, we established a program of raising funds for Bascom professorships. They weren't the fully endowed chair type professorship, but they were professorships which provided additional auxiliary allowances for the professors. No salary increase, but gave them the opportunity to hire assistants or attend Learned Society meetings or get more computer time or whatever was necessary. And those took off really like mad, to the point that I believe we have over 60 of them either in force or in a process of being funded. But it also established the great need for professorships, and people with higher goals than we had for the Bascom professorship, which initially were really only $100,000, and then they went to $200,000. They're now $250,000 to $500,000 for the endowment. But when people who had the means to do more saw what good these professorship were doing, they became interested in full-blown professorships, which range from $500,000 to $1 million, and fully endowed chairs, which took off at $1 million and up. So I don't have the exact number of those, but compared to the early days, we really took off from about 1980 on. In the last decade, we've quadrupled and then some, I'm sure, our support of professorships.
This is getting a bit ahead of the story, but since we're on it, let's go with it for just a couple minutes. Is there any reason why at this particular time in UW's history, we said the late 70s, 80s, around there when the professorships really took off, what was the need? What brought about this sudden rise in the profession?
Well, the need was that Wisconsin had lagged behind in the payment it was making to its professors. And while we had Vilas professorships and a few full-blown professorships that were instrumental in keeping the real big stars, the university was faced with the loss of a lot of middle-range professors, the young professors coming up who would be the bright stars of tomorrow. And both President Harrington and Chancellor Young saw that and experienced the outflow of bright young people who would be our future stars and deans and whatnot. So that is what precipitated the establishment of the Bascom Professorships. And out of that grew really more attention to the major professorships and chairs, and that's how that came about.
Now, when this whole process would take place, would you tell them that you had money for a professorship? Would they come with a name or a department or an area, or how did that work?
Well, in the Bascom Professorships, in order to encourage the donors to give money, we allowed them to name the discipline that the money would be for. It was logical that someone who had graduated from electrical engineering and had a very successful career in that field would want to give money for electrical engineering professorship. That wasn't always true. We had one accountant I can recall who gave money for a professorship in art history. And we've had a number of people like that. Another gentleman who graduated in dairy industry established a professorship in conservation because he was very much interested. And then he established a second one in the School of Business. So he did not go back to his basic discipline, but he went more to what he had, what his career was in life, and I suppose that was a means of thanking the university for making it possible to have a career in a field related to his discipline, but perhaps not exactly in it.
Did these people then also get the chance to name the professorship after a famous professor?
No. What we did for the Bascom Professorships, it became the John Jones - Bascom Professorship, and the John Jones was the donor. Now, I mentioned that the donor could name the field that he wanted that professorship in, and the actual naming of the professorship. The donor had nothing to do with that. That was strictly the prerogative, as it always has been and always will be, of the university to name the professor. The administration and the region pick the professors, but we do honor the donor by naming the professorship after him or her.
And this is your chance, or the university's chance, then, to locate this young professor who looks like he might or she might turn out to be real.
Yeah. I can say that there have been instances where we may have thought we knew who the professor was, but the name was never mentioned, but where the administration would come to us and say, do you have anyone interested in nuclear engineering, for example? And I happened to think of someone that was interested in nuclear engineering, and that was David Granger of the Granger Foundation, and he was very interested when I approached him about the possibility of supporting a professorship in nuclear engineering. He subsequently did fund that professorship, and we have for several years now had Gerald Kulczynski in that professorship. I think the professorship helped save Kulczynski for the university. But his chairman came to us and without mentioning him said, we're desperate. He and the dean of engineering said, we're desperate. We've got to have some support of a professorship in this field in order to attract top people and keep them. And that's how that came about.
Yeah, Kulczynski is a good find, too. I heard him speak the other day on some of the work he's doing on the moon.
Yeah, he's a marvelous professor.
He's on the athletic board, too.
Yes, he was chairman of the search committee that that hired Pat Richter, so he's been very busy. He's an unusual young man in that he was a three-year starter on the football team, played in the Rose Bowl, and went on to get his PhD in nuclear engineering, and is one of the premier nuclear scientists in the country, and still keeps his interest by being a member of the athletic board, interests in athletics.
To save our typist some trouble, we're at the end of the tape, I'm going to turn it over. Let's spell Kulsinski for her.
Kulsinski, or Kulcinski.
Okay, there you are. Thank you. End of side one. This is Barry Tyker. I'm still with Robert Renebaum. We're going to talk a little bit about his early years as executive director, right?
Right.
President later of the foundation. Okay, you're up in the bank building over on Park and Regent. What happened those first few years in terms of operating budget, that money that you earned, personnel and areas like that?
Well, as I mentioned, we moved from the bank building to Sterling Court in an old building where we literally froze to death because they had an old furnace in the basement that didn't work right. But we were in that building while the Wisconsin Center was being constructed. We had raised the necessary $2.5 million and construction, I believe it was groundbreaking, was in 1957 or 56, and we dedicated the building in April of 1958. Along with the dedication, the foundation moved its offices into the third floor of the Wisconsin Center. Part of the deed of transfer stated that the university was to provide adequate office space for the foundation in the Wisconsin Center. At that time, adequate space consisted of really four small offices, one for filing, one for Mr. Peterson, one for myself, and one for the secretary. Eventually, we doubled the size of that space in the Wisconsin Center, and eventually tripled it. And even with the tripling of the size, when we were up to about 50 people, the space was inadequate. So that accounts for our present location in the Varick's building on East Gilman Street. But going back to our move into the Wisconsin Center, we were able to show to the public this wonderful building, the Wisconsin Center, that came 100% from private gifts. And it established a benchmark for us in the fundraising business, that people could see how successful a combined effort would be in providing a building of this sort, which was entirely for adult education, seminars, and the like. Statewide meetings would take place in the center. That it became easier for us to really raise money from both corporations and foundations, as well as individuals, by having this wonderful stewardship report of the Wisconsin Center to offer. Meanwhile, we had raised a lot of money for scholarships and the like, so we were touching many more areas of the university, and many of the professors were steering us on to prospects, people that they had as students who went on to great success, and we were able to call on these people, and perhaps up to that time they hadn't done anything in the way of supporting the university other than the moral support all alumni seem to give, and we were able to start a program of cultivation of these prospects. That meant we had to add people to our staff and increase the budget, but all that while our intake was going up, so it was a perfectly logical process to increase the size of the staff. We remained an organization of I don't know quite how to explain it, but we concentrated on the entire university. All of the members of the staff worked really for the benefit of the whole university. That's still true today, but in the early 1980s, we established what we call constituency fundraising, and that meant we hired a fundraiser for the College of Letters and Science, one for CALS, one for education, law school, medical school, and the like. And subsequently, some of those colleges and schools now have two fundraisers, and that meant additional secretarial help, it meant additional research help. So we've had very, very rapid growth. I'm not sure of these dates, but I would guess that in 1980 we had a staff of 9 people, and by the end of the 1980s we were up to 66 people. So we grew tremendously in the last 10 years, having grown only from 2 people when we started to 9 in 1980.
That's really impressive. I had no idea that the last decade has been that. You mentioned a little while back about the tax laws that came into effect after World War II that helped you by allowing corporations and whatnot to donate to you. Mm-hmm. How did that tax laws, that particular tax law change, or did it change, and were there other incentives or disincentives in that area, state and nationally?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first tax, of course, was the excess profits tax of World War II. And as soon as the war was over with and war production stopped, the excess profits tax went off. But there always has been tax incentives to help people make major gifts that were deductible to charitable and educational organizations. That has changed from time to time. Tax Act of 1962 and the Tax Act of 1986. There have been modifications in there, but nothing basically has changed. It's still very attractive tax-wise for big income people to make significant contributions to organizations like us. So we haven't tried to sell anybody on the tax aspect of their giving. We mention it and acquaint them with the advantages offered, but we have still always tried to establish a case for giving to the University of Wisconsin as a primary reason for somebody giving. The tax benefits are something extra that go hand in hand with it. And there's no doubt that many gifts are made because of the tax incentives, but we like to feel that most of our giving comes from people who recognize the need for private support of the university.
You mentioned this increase in size and also the way they've divided. We have a fundraiser for each college now, sort of a principal fundraiser. When the foundation began in 1945 and up through your merger, up through these dramatic changes in the last decade, what kind of fundraising techniques were generally employed by the foundation?
Well, when I came with the foundation in 1955, the first thing I did was organize a formal annual fund appeal, which was primarily direct mail at the time. And we mailed out, as I recall, over 100,000 pieces of literature that first year and got something like $67,000 back, more than paid for the mailing, but it was just the base for what was to become an extremely successful program, which today consists of direct mail and telephone solicitation of alumni. And we've had tremendous growth in the number of annual gifts by particularly since we started telephoning people. I believe that's been about 4 years now. And the other program that we established back in 1955, we established a deferred giving committee made up of lawyers from throughout the state and in principal cities throughout the country. And these people got together and advised us on how we could encourage bequests and life income gifts and the like. And I was warned by people who had been in the deferred giving programs already that they didn't develop results immediately, that you would encourage people to write, include the University of Wisconsin Foundation in their will, and they usually didn't die the next day. And a prediction was made that in about 10 years you'll see the fruits of this labor. And it took, we had a few odds and ends of bequests that came in, but it was almost like clockwork. At the end of 10 years, the bequests started to come in, and they come in on a literally a weekly basis today, because so many people did not have wills, or if they did have wills, they didn't have charitable bequests in the wills. And when we laid it out in front of them with a very nice book that told the needs of the university and told them how to approach their lawyer and how to establish a bequest in their will, it's amazing. It was just like clockwork. From 10 years on, that program has just grown by leaps and bounds.
Are these people who leave money in their wills, are they able to direct that money towards specific souls?
Most major bequests are directed towards a particular discipline, or directed towards a professorship, or directed towards research in some disease that may have bothered the family of the individual making the bequest. We do get a lot of small bequests, which are wonderful to receive. They're usually unrestricted, but when we get an unrestricted bequest, we have kind of it's not a joke, it's a serious matter, but it's a joke to the extent that we call it Slichter's Law. Alan Slichter, one of the sons of the famous Dean Slichter, was a director of the foundation, as was his brother Donald. And Alan was insistent that he didn't have to insist too hard because everybody felt the same way, but he was most insistent that any unrestricted bequest the foundation received was to be used in a manner that wouldn't make the donor turn over in his grave, so to speak. And we would confer with the family, we would confer with the donor's attorney, his or her friends, anybody that had any knowledge of the donor, we would ask, what do you think the donor would have liked to have us do? Or we'd look back at his giving record, and if the individual supported, for example, the Elvium Art Center for the last 10 years before he died and then left us an unrestricted bequest, we would assume that that person was very much interested in the Elvium, and we would try to establish a program in the Elvium in his honor. But we continue that. That's an unwritten, or you might say a written law of the foundation, that we don't want anybody to turn over in their grave.
Or any family matter to get upset about.
Yes, right.
Like that too.
Because if we're going to be good stewards and expect others to make a bequest to us, we must be diligent in using the money appropriately that has been given to us.
Of course. In terms of the amount of money you raise on the year, on an annual basis now, we have, of course, the special projects like Elvium, but what about just has the annual budget amount of money raised just gone up gradually over time, or is it recession-proof? How does that work?
Generally speaking, our total giving dollars, well, I don't have to say generally speaking, it's a fact that our giving dollars have increased every year since 1955 through 1989, with one exception, and that was back in the late 60s when the riots first hit the campus. We took a dip I forget the year, but the year of the first riots, we had a number of people stop giving, and we had a couple of bequests canceled and the like. But as soon as our friends saw that we weren't unique, that this was going on at colleges all over the country, they saw it going on in cities like Detroit and Los Angeles and Chicago, they didn't fault the University of Wisconsin for having been the victim of riots and unrest. And they came back to us in pretty good numbers, and we were able to get ourselves back on the upward trend, which has, as I say, has been unbroken since 1955, when we started our annual program.
Now, I, for some reason, had never associated the effect of the riots on the foundation, mm-hmm. but of course they would have an impact. Did people call you up? Was there any kind of thing? Were you actively alerted by people that they were very upset, or how did you handle?
Oh, yes.
How did you handle the whole thing?
Well, we would get letters back from people in response to our direct mail appeal or individual letter appeals to an individual. We would get response back that. I'm simply not going to give to a university that permits that type of behavior or various things like that. We had the unfortunate experience, I swear, for 3 years in a row, this may not be exactly true, but there would always be a major riot or demonstration that would take place on alumni weekend when we had all of our alumni back, and particularly the 50-year class. Well, these were a bunch of 70-year-old people that would come to the campus expecting to see apple blossoms and the like, and all of the events were scheduled in the union, and a couple of the times they were tear gassed, had occasion to see some of the real unrest going on, and it just seemed that it was our misfortune to have all this go on alumni weekend. And I can recall specifically of a gentleman who left here, went back to Washington, D.C., and advised me and one of our directors that he had removed us from his will. And I went to see him, and the director, who was a classmate and close personal friend of his, went to see him, and we both talked to him that the university was bigger than a few people protesting some particular, for the most part, I guess it was the Vietnam War. And fortunately for us, this gentleman put us back in the will about a year before he died, and we did receive over $1 million as a result of it. But it was out of his will for a period of 2 years, I know that.
Did you ever consider moving Alumni Weekend to January?
We should have, I guess.
Was there anything else ever like this in your tenure here, like that reaction to Vietnam?
No. Of course, some of the protests and riots had to do with civil rights, others with the Vietnam War. There was one strike that became quite noticeable, and that was the teaching assistant strike. I forget the year of that. And then of course, the climax was the bombing of Sterling Hall by the protesters, and that bombing took place in the summer of 1970, as I recall, and it was also 10 days, it was in August, which was about 10 days before the time we were to dedicate the L.V. Mart Center. And we had plans to bring alumni in from all over the country, and it was a black tie affair, and it was to be outdoors on the terraces near the LVM, and the atmosphere in the campus was very tense. We debated for a couple days whether to cancel the thing, and we thought, no, we must show the university in a way that it's going to go on, you know, regardless of what some people may try to do to it. So we did have the opening, and it was without incident, and it was a wonderful success, and it helped bridge, I think, the gap from the bombing and the lowest point of the university to the post-Vietnam War era, when we've had tremendous success.
Well, I think it's been pretty much generally acknowledged that bombing really did take the bottom out of the student uprising and the wind out of the sails, so to speak, and was the turning point in the
Particularly the fact that the young man Fasnacht was killed in the bombing, that turned everybody off who at that point may have been sympathetic to the cause of the protesters, but certainly not to their method of protesting. I still find it difficult to accept the fact that the university was to be punished for the Vietnam War, and it was punished through some of the action. But I also take great pride in knowing that the university never shut down. Several other universities were forced to shut down, but Wisconsin never shut down for a minute, and I think that was something we could all be proud of.
Well, I also imagine you and your unit down at the Wisconsin Center, which is pretty close to where things are happening down there.
Oh, yes.
You must have been in a pretty defensive posture for a while during that Vietnam thing.
We were indeed, and the protests against the Army Math Center were felt very keenly by us, because one day a group of mathematicians from throughout the country were in for a mathematics conference, and one of the speakers at the conference was somebody from the Army Math Center, and the protesters came in with cans of red paint into the auditorium of the Wisconsin Center and threw the paint all over the people who were sitting there. And one of the mathematicians was from California, who was at that time a good friend of mine, remains a good friend of mine. Dell Zilmer is his name. Well, Dell came out, he had red paint on his face and red paint on a beautiful tweed sport coat, and he's, you know, I was just embarrassed as could be when I saw him that way, and he said, well, don't feel badly, it's not the university.
We're going to change subjects a little bit here now. We have a legislature over at just a few blocks away from here.
Yes.
A few blocks away from you mm-hmm. people throughout your state. And you're raising all this money,
mm-hmm.
and they're over there. And I know mm-hmm. how those guys react to money and things like that. Did you have any kind of relationship with the legislature? Did they ever have any influence or try to influence you or anything along those lines?
During my tenure, I always kept completely away from the legislature or any activity in politics whatsoever. I felt I had a position that had to be nonpartisan, even though my family is known for a former Republican governor. I have always maintained a strictly hands-off of politics, and I think it has helped us, because we haven't had any difficulty with the legislature until recent years, when we have had tremendous success, and it was thought that perhaps the money we were raising could be better spent by the legislature, I guess. In 1985, there was a legislative audit of the athletic department, and we handled certain funds for the athletic department, not their major funds, of course, but the gift funds that they were able to receive were here. And the Legislative Audit Bureau felt they had free access to our records, which they did not. And we would not allow, we were perfectly willing to give them the information they needed, but not permit an audit of our books or a fishing expedition, so to speak. And there was considerable publicity about it, but we established quite definitely that we are a separate and private organization. We're governed by the rules of the Internal Revenue Service and the state of Wisconsin, for that matter, the Department of Revenue. We make complete reports to both organizations. We submit a certified public accounting of our activities and answer all of the necessary papers and make that all available to the appropriate channels, but still we're not an open book. Our primary concern is that when you involve legislators and newspapers, you're encouraging the possible divulgence of names of donors or publishing in a paper. And if we were to be required to publish all of our donors and the amount of their gifts in the paper, which some people were suggesting, that we would just be providing a nice list of prospects for every other university and college in the Midwest and every other fundraising organization. People, particularly major donors, they may be willing to have their name attached to a program, usually after their death, but they don't want to be known as a heavy hitter in some circles.
Well, we have an example of that in this morning's State Journal, don't we? The
right,
business school, right. The gentleman who's going
to
buy
$20 million. We're worried sick that some way or another they'll dig up the name or find some technicality in the law that the university has to divulge this name to make sure it's not a criminal or a crook that's proposing to give this multi-million-dollar gift. We're very much afraid that the name will be divulged before the whole transaction takes place, and we could very well lose it because the donor has made it very clear that there's be no publicity on this.
What about the newspapers, the Cap Times and the State Journal, during your involvement with the foundation? How has their treatment of you been?
Been extremely supportive. We've had wonderful cooperation. If we've got a major story to tell, they cover it nicely, and we've had a good relationship. And both newspapers, through their various foundations, and including the EVU Foundation, which is an arm of the charitable arm of the Capital Times, have made substantial contributions to us. They haven't given us a blank check as far as being above criticism. If they didn't like something or didn't like a project we're working on, they've mentioned it editorially and otherwise. But I must say that they've been extremely helpful to us.
What about the city of Madison? What's your relationship with them, if any?
Do you mean from a political standpoint, the city council and
the city? We
don't really have a great deal to do with the city of Madison. We did have one confrontation, if you want to call it that, when we were trying to develop the golf course, University Golf Course, 17 years ago. We needed the money from the sale of the extra land we had to finish the funding of the golf course, and the city was the primary force in preventing us from having residential development around the golf course, even though we had sought out the best land planner we could find, one that was tuned into all the environmental concerns, and we were going to concentrate the housing in certain areas of the overall golf course development. The money we would have had for that would have paid for the golf course, but the city fought us on that, and we long ago learned you can't fight City Hall, so we backed off and went out and quietly tried to get the additional money that we would have otherwise earned from the sale of land. And that's why it took us an extra 17 years to get the money to build the golf course, which is now underway.
Yeah, that the golf course is an interesting story. Mm-hmm. It was one I was going to hit a little later on. It's been a long-term project for you, for
right.
people. Was there any other opposition you've run into besides that which you just described?
Well, no, that was, the city fought us, but of course there were environmental groups in town, the Capital Community Citizens, and other individuals who fought us at the time, and but other than that, we've had no problems with the city. Most of the contacts with the city are with the university and the city, not the foundation. We've tried to, again, keep out of politics. We're not politicians. We're not interested in those activities.
What about Hilldale?
Hilldale was a development of the foundation. It's initiated back in the, I think, started in the early 60s, the planning for it, and the shopping center is now, I believe, 28 years old. But the foundation is the sole stockholder in Hilldale. It doesn't run the shopping center because that would be unrelated business activity for us, but it's just as we might own stock in General Motors or Ford Motor Company, we own all the stock there is in Hilldale. And that Hilldale is operated by a company called Hilldale Inc., which pays full city real estate taxes and state and federal income taxes. So it's a fully taxable entity, but all of the proceeds after that come to the university.
What was that land before?
That was the university's experimental farm, its main experimental farm. I think it was 600 and some acres where they conducted all of their dairy research and bee research and so forth. And then the late 1950s, the university decided that the city was growing around the farm and that it should be sold off and moved out farther so it wouldn't be a source of flies and odors and whatnot for the Madison community. So the university hired a planner, Larry Smith and associates from Seattle, who planned the Hill Farm housing development, the Hill Farm apartment development, the Hill Farm, the houses were buffeted from the what is now the shopping center by first professional buildings and a high-rise office buildings, then a park, then the houses began. And in making the plans, he carved out the 33 acres at the corner of University and Midvale Boulevard for a shopping center. And that's how that came to be.
And that's the part that you own stock. You don't own stock or anything else around
there? No. We own a couple of the buildings surrounding the shopping center, but you see, the university itself could not develop a shopping center. However, the foundation as a separate entity could, through the device of buying stock and forming a corporation at arm's length, could save that valuable piece of land for the university. And it's now producing pretty close to $1 million a year, which is used primarily for professorships and special activities of the university, lectures and the like.
What about the McLean Sports Center?
Well, the McLean Sports Center is still not out of the woods in that there's a sizable debt on the building, but that was built before the money was raised, which was a basic fault in that program, because once a building is up, there's no sense of urgency anymore as far as raising money. But it was deemed necessary at the time. We had just hired Don Morton as a new football coach and a new athletic director, and all of the other Big Ten universities had indoor practice facilities. We had to have one, and I think we could have built a less expensive one, but there was an attempt to make it blend in exactly with the existing shell there, and that added a substantial amount for the roof that put it into a much higher cost category than was originally intended. So fortunately, the state has helped by permitting bonding or assuming some of the debt, but it's yet to be paid for by the National W Club and the foundation through gifts that it receives. We have no liability there. The foundation doesn't beyond the money we take in for that purpose, that is committed to go to pay off that debt.
Do you and the W Club expect to have that paid off in the near future? Or?
Well, I think there's much more hope now with a new football program and everybody all excited about that, that the crowds might return to the stadium. And if they do, I heard Pat Richter say the other day that just a 10,000 increase per game average would mean $600,000 to us. And not only that, but it means a great deal to the W Club, which sells programs and handles the concessions at the game. They had a great drop in this year's receipts because there was nobody there to buy their Cokes and hot dogs and the programs.
How did the foundation get involved with the sports center, with the athletic?
Well, the foundation is a fundraising agency for the entire university, including the athletic department. And the athletic department has two fundraisers on our staff who do nothing but go out and bring contributions in. And incidentally, they're giving increased something over $100,000 last year. I think it was from $2.9 million to $4 million something last year. So despite a losing season and a lot of grumbling, we did increase through a more aggressive fundraising program, and that program is being stepped up right along, and I'm sure with Pat Richter and Barry Alvarez that we'll be able to lure more people back in, and if they come back in, they're a much better target to give money if they're willing to come to the game.
University Bay Marsh Project, what was that?
Excuse me?
The University Bay Marsh Project.
Oh. We always work with the 50-year classes and their 50th reunion to come up with a significant gift to the university. And the class of 1918 asked the university what its needs were. Well, among other things, somebody said, we want to clean up the marsh out here and make a pond or a lake there, a permanent pond or lake. And the class of 18 thought that was a pretty good idea. Well, there were some young people in the wildlife department and the limnology department who recognized that marsh as being essential for the Lake Mendota, and to convert it into just another pond, another lake there, would take away the filtering action of the marsh. So they approached the university and subsequently the class officers of 1918 and said, would you help us clean up the marsh but retain it as a marsh rather than make it a pond or a little lake? And it was very interesting because here we had a bunch of 20-year-old people interested in one thing, approaching these 70-year-old people who had graduated from here 50 years ago. And they fell right in line, thought that was a wonderful idea. So the two of them, the 20-year-olds and the 70-year-olds, got together and cleaned up the marsh, and it's now called the Class of 1918 Marsh, and it has lookout stations where people can go observe the wildlife, and it's a beautiful spot on the campus.
That's off by Picnic Point.
Yes.
I live in Eagle
It
Heights.
Just shows you that cooperation is much better than confrontation. They got together in a friendly way and explained each other's role, and it worked out beautifully.
I have one last brief question here, and this is relating again to the sports, although not the sports center. When is Wisconsin going to the Rose Bowl? Who are they going to play, and what's the score going to be? This is for posterity here.
For
now,
posterity?
So I want your prediction.
I'm going to say that Wisconsin will go to the Rose Bowl 3 years, 4 years at the outside, and that
1994.
By 1994, and obviously, if the Pac-10 continues in its present pace, we'll be playing either Southern California or UCLA.
Okay, put yourself out on a limb. Which one?
I would say Southern California.
What's the score?
Be 34-20. We'll win.
Okay. That's the end. Remember that whoever's listening to this tape 50 years from now, this is February 7th, 1990, and we just got a prediction 4 years down the line.
Speaking of that, Barry, I brought a tape down the other day, terribly scratchy, of an interview at halftime in 1956. I was interviewed in the football game at the half of the Marquette game. And we were ahead by a pretty good score, and you can just barely hear it. It's in such bad shape, but it was a lot of fun to listen to it.